This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow coming to you from the Brown Theater in Louisville, Kentucky. And our theme tonight is, of course, On the Rocks. And one of the things Kentucky is famous for is places where the rock isn't actually there anymore. I didn't know this. Did you know that Kentucky has 5,000 caves? 5,000 caves. I couldn't believe that. And well, we had to see one of these caves for ourselves. So our Science Friday producers headed down Interstate 65 to visit Crump's Cave in southern Kentucky to tour the underground lab of a couple of cave scientists. And they sent us back this audio postcard.
All right, so the first rule and first thing we should do is turn our lights on. This is Crump's Cave. We are going to go down and unlock the gate to the cave, and we'll walk down a small trail, about 50 feet or so, and we'll go to a waterfall. And in the waterfall, we have all of our research equipment set up. I am Jason Polk, and I am an associate professor of geosciences at Western Kentucky University, and I also direct the Center for Human Geoenvironmental Studies.
I am Fernando Hernandez, and I am a graduate student over here at Western Kentucky, and I'm studying springs in the Cumberland Plateau in Tennessee.
Just be careful of your footing in this first part because it's just loose rocks. So that sound you hear is water that is flowing out of a layer in the rock and falling as a waterfall and will flow until it reaches the actual water table for the region.
Look at this.
Whoa. What is that?
Just a cave cricket.
They're one of the main sources of energy inside the caves. So all the other critters that live inside, some of them never go out, but the crickets every night, they go outside of the cave, forage, come back, and other critters like salamanders or even pseudoscorpions or smaller things that live inside the cave eat either them or their poop or something out of them. So they're normally the backbone of the whole food cycle in the caves. So they're small and tiny, but they're really important inside here.
Looks like you got a bunch of leaky buckets over here.
We definitely do. This is our monitoring station. So we capture the water in the barrel to measure the level and flow, and then it flows into a smaller bucket where we have the sonde with the probes. It's like taking a little snapshot. You know, we were able to pull a sample and capture it before it becomes part of the overall system. And from those water samples, we'll analyze them for things like E. coli. We'll look at all the different dissolved chemicals in the water. We can analyze for things like atrazine, which is a really commonly used herbicide here in Kentucky. And we're gonna walk down to the next waterfall that's in the cave. Everybody just watch your step. And about 25% of the world's population, so literally billions of people, depend on these types of systems for their drinking water. A lot of people don't really understand that all the things we study with pollution and contaminants and whatnot all does have bigger impacts too. This is the end of a portion of the cave that we own and what's really safe for us to keep doing without some additional training and gear. But anybody want a cricket for the road? If not, then we'll make our escape because it's cold in here.
Yeah, crickets. They do say that it is the food of the future. So that was Jason Polk and Fernando Hernandez of Western Kentucky University at Crump's Cave. And if you've ever had the chance to visit a cave, one of the things you might have seen is the incredible spectacle of huge swarms of bats, right, flying out of the cave at incredibly fast speeds. I mean, you're talking thousands of bats. But did you ever wonder how they do that without hitting each other, without running into each other? Or you say, oh yeah, I've heard about that echolocation. Well, let me play you a sample of what echolocating bats leaving the bat cave sounds like. Sounds like a little sand, right? You really can't make any sense out of it. It's hard to understand, so I'm going to slow it down for you a little. I'm going to slow it down to make it 20 times slower. Still confused by that. How do they know where they're going and, you know, how do they know not to hit each other? The bats are somehow able to use these signals to communicate with themselves perfectly in their swarms. So we humans may have a lot to learn about how to communicate and how to echolocate from these bats. And my next guest says she wants to save the world by studying bats. How she's going to do that, I don't know, but we're going to ask her. Laura Klepper is an assistant professor of biology at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you say you study the bats to save the world. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's my tagline that I give people. So, as any good scientist, we have to be able to explain why we do what we do in terms of why this is, you know, the societal relevance or why, aside from just the pure interest in wanting to do science, what is the benefit for humanity? So I study biological sonar. I study not just bats, I also study dolphins. So both of those animals use biological sonar. And we've been studying these animals for almost a century now in order to do what we call biomimicry, which is to understand what the animals are doing to do something that benefits us. And for us, that would be sonar. So by studying these animals, we're learning how to make our own sonar devices.
Yeah, well, we use sonar in submarines and things like that, but it seems like the bats have really got it down differently. It's a much more complex thing that they're doing.
It is incredible. In fact, basically what they're doing, the reason why I study what the bats are doing is that all we know about science, physics, biology, says that they're doing an impossible task by echolocating in these large groups. What we know about how echolocation works is that when they're in these groups, the signals from each bat should be interfering with each other, and they should not be able to be using their sonar. They should be jamming their sonar and colliding and falling to the ground. But despite what we think is impossible, the bats are doing this, and they've been doing it this way for millions of years. So that just means we're missing part of the equation.
Must be missing a lot of that part.
We are missing quite a lot.
Of the equation. I understand that you've invented some unusual ways to study these bats from actually within the swarm.
From
you get into
the swarm. Yeah. You know, I like to say that as a scientist, I have the coolest job on the planet because I get paid to develop and play with really cool toys, and then I get to take my toys to really fun locations, and then I get to tell everybody about the fun I'm doing in the field. So one of the questions that I'm ultimately wanting to get at is, what is it like to be a bat? And in order to really understand what it's like to be a bat, you need to get inside the swarm of those bats. You have to pretend like you're a bat. Now, I can't put on my Batman costume and fly into the swarm of the bats, so we invented a few unusual technologies in order to do this and get inside the swarm.
Such as
zip lines.
Zip lines.
Zip lines.
You get on a zip line?
No. I do not get on a zip line. We put our recorders on a zip line, and we fly our zip lines through the swarm of the bats so that we have our recording microphone matching the speed of the bats as it's going through the bat swarm. We also use drones.
Drones.
We fly drones. Yes.
Makes sense.
Yes. We put the drones up to get up off the ground. And then probably a favorite among the students in my lab is we have a hawk that we use to fly through the bats.
Hawk is not eating lunch going through the bats, is it?
No. Our hawk is not eating the bats. We've trained this hawk. Our hawk is named Belle after our school's mascot, the St. Mary's Bells. We have trained this hawk. It's been raised ever since it was a chick, so it's been hand-raised. And it knows it just flies from handler to handler, and it gets jackrabbit as its reward because we're in the fields of New Mexico. And this hawk carries a custom-built microphone and video unit and flies through the bats to get video and audio recording for us of the bats within the swarm.
Okay, so let's say I understand that you're trying to understand how good the bats are and how they do this. What kind of applications would you use the sonar that they do?
Right. So we use sonar in a lot of devices in everyday life. Sonar, for example, we use it to map the ocean floor. We use sonar for a form of sonar for self-driving vehicles underwater or for fish finders. Self-driving cars, they don't use sonar exactly. They use radar, but the same processing is the same idea. So one of the technological problems that we're working on as we have this rise in technology in our society is the need for automated transport, automated sensing is growing. And how you can have multiple vehicles in space using sonar is something that we haven't quite figured out, so we're looking to the bats for the solution.
You know, that really just hit home with me because we're talking about having thousands of cars on the road not hitting each other. The bats have figured out how to do that already. Tens of thousands of bats not bumping into each other. And that's what you want to know, how they do that.
That's what I hope to answer.
Well, tell us what it's like. So you follow these bats, or tens of thousands of bats, could be even more than that, right? What's a bat cave really like?
A bat cave is one of the coolest habitats on the planet. I'm a little biased, but... So let's see if I can take you into a bat cave.
Take me in.
Take you into a bat cave. So first of all, you can't just walk into a bat cave like this. We have to protect both the bats from us as well as us from the bats. So we wear sterile protective suits, waterproof Tyvek suits. Additionally, inside the bat cave, the caves I go to have about 500,000 bats or so.
A 500,000 in the cave?
Oh, yeah.
One cave. Well, look how you're looking at me like that's really cool.
It's so cool.
So you wear the special outfits.
So, Tyvek suit. We also have to wear a full-face respirator because there's so many bats inside the cave. They're urinating, they're defecating, so the ammonia levels are very high, so we have to protect our breathing. And there's also a toxic fungal spore inside the cave, histoplasmosis, which can cause all kinds of respiratory ailments. So we wear a lot of protective gear inside the cave, but that's not even the coolest part. So when you enter the cave...
You got me.
I know.
I'm waiting for the coolest part.
I wish I could take you there tonight, Ira. It's fantastic.
What time is it?
So when you start walking into the cave, you have all these bats inside a cave, and the bats are, they're always defecating. So the guano starts to build up, and it builds up like a giant sand dune inside the cave. So when we enter the cave, we walk up the sand dune, and you kind of squish down, you squish into it. But not just that. There's all these insects in the cave that live off of the guano, as well as it's a maternal cave, so there's baby bats that are just born. And, baby bats, there's a high mortality rate from the newborns. They fall from the cave ceiling. So the moment they land on the ground, there's a special type of beetle that starts eating the flesh of the baby bats alive. So the whole ground is moving and just seething with this movement.
So you're crawling up a mountain of guano. The floor is moving all around you. There are bats hanging from the ceiling.
No, they're flying around.
They're flying.
You've disturbed them at this point. Around. So they're smacking into your head.
Are they smacking? Are people afraid that bats get in your hair? Is that a myth, or do they?
Well, we cover our heads.
Oh.
So.
But and how about if you have 100,000 bats or whatever in a cave?
500,000.
Excuse me, I don't mean to shortchange it. Now they have all that body heat. Do they heat the cave up?
They do. That cave gets very hot. In fact, when they're in the cave in tight clusters, the temperature inside the clusters of the bats can exceed the body temperature. We know this because we take special thermal cameras in there that can tell us the exact temperature measurement from within the cave. So because the bats are... they can create such high temperatures. That's part of the reason also why they're always moving around and milling about within the cave is to get rid of some of those temperatures. And just being in the cave, too... it's very hot as a researcher because you're wearing a suit that doesn't breathe, so you get very sweaty.
How often do you do this?
I do this every summer for a month with my undergraduate students.
And look at you smiling about
it. It's fantastic.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Laura Klepper, Assistant Professor of Biology at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana. I don't think there's a person who loves bats more than you do.
I don't know. There might be a few out there.
A few out there. Yeah. Now, I understand. See, a little birdie told me that you do a mean bat impression.
Oh, yeah.
Come on.
I do.
Give us. Don't you want to see her impression? Yeah.
Well, I have to give you a little bit of backstory beforehand. So, first of all, when the bats are echolocating, they're not just keeping their heads straight. They're scanning their environment with their heads, as well as they can move their ears independently to perceive the echo. So, when I do my bat impression, I go...
Wow. We've had a lot of demonstrations on Science Friday, but never such a unique bat impression.
You know, you spend a lot of time with bats, and you begin to learn them.
Go
a little
batty.
Bit. Yeah, well, perhaps.
Where did that expression come from? Does it have anything to do with bats? Can we go batty?
I believe it does. Yeah, I believe it has to do with some of the chemicals inside the bat cave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I love that the little thing you did, the sound. Can you do the sound one more time? I'm a sound guy. I love that.
Well, do you want to hear my slowed down bat call? Because that's in real time.
Absolutely. Slowed down bat call by Laura Klepper.
So backstory, I have to give backstory as a scientist. So the bats, these bats make what we call frequency modulated calls, which means they change in pitch over time. So although in real time we might hear, really what they're doing is they're going pew, pew, pew.
Wow. Oh no. Two for the price of one. That's great. Can you teach that? Do you teach that to your students?
My students actually do a fantastic bat impression. It's part of the assignment in my lab.
On a Friday night when you're getting together after the lab is done, you're all doing the bat call together anytime?
It's kind of our signal to call each other at times in the hallway.
I know, I understand that you teach an all-women's undergraduate college.
I do.
And I understand that it's been a great opportunity for you to get many young women involved
in
this field.
It is, yeah. I have a really lively group of students. I've gotten lots of students excited about bats, despite them never thinking they would be excited about bats. So we try to help spread the bat love and the bat joy around our campus.
Let's see if anybody in our audience. Yes, step up. Go ahead.
You mentioned how your work could save the world. Not too many years ago, on All Things Considered, there was an echolocation story about Daniel Kish, mm-hmm. how he could ride a bike, and can you comment on how a human could develop that?
Right, so there's a lot of people in my field that are trying to study human echolocation to understand exactly the mechanism with it, but when I work with school groups, I like to do a demo to show that we are all capable of a very rudimentary form of echolocation. You know, I have them have a person close their eyes, and it's this clicking mechanism, this it makes what we call a broadband signal, which is a wide range of frequencies, and because it's a short duration, impulsive signal, it gives you really good information about your environment. And so I encourage you all to go home tonight and practice, and if you have someone put something up in front of your face with your eyes closed while you're clicking, you can actually detect the difference with your ear. And so it's thought that when people lose one of their senses, especially with vision, their hearing can become even more heightened, and so that's how they're able to use their echolocation.
Well, Dr. Klepper, this is incredibly fascinating. I want to thank you for taking time to be with
us
today. Laura Klepper is an assistant professor of biology at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana, and playing us to the break, Bridge 19.